So good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining us for our Tuesday Tips featuring UKS. Today, they're going to be talking to you about positioning your business for success when Connecticut reopens. Just wanted to go over a few things real quick. So as you notice, everybody will be on mute when you come in. There is a chat button at the bottom if you have a question. We will get to those at the end, but please use that chat button for those questions. For those of you who are calling on the phone, please send your questions into info@middlesexchamber.com. And I repeat, that's info@middlesexchamber.com. Once we are done with our presentation, we will open it up for those questions. I would like to really thank Rich Carella and his amazing team here who are going to step you through everything today. And without further ado, Rich Carella will now introduce today's panelists.
Great. Thanks, Johanna, and welcome everyone. Yeah, we've enjoyed doing this the last couple of weeks, and this is one of several that our firm partners have been doing. It's really evolving rapidly, and so trying to stay on top of it is difficult. We'll discuss as much as we can today, and happy to answer your questions. Starting off today will be Chris Brigham and Valerie Ferdone. They are partners with our employment law practice group. Chris is going to be talking about unemployment issues and Valerie about return to work issues. Then we'll switch over to myself. I'll be talking about the PPP loan program now that those are being funded, the best use and eligible uses for those funds and how that plays out with recent SBA guidance. Then we'll turn over to Don Seifel, who's on the phone. He's a tax partner with our firm, and he'll talk about some tax issues, local, state, and federal tax issues on all of the stuff that's been rolling out, whether it be the executive orders by the governor or the PPP loan. And then last, we'll have Rick DeGello rounded out with some concerning issues about the PPP loan and fraud enforcement by the SBA and Treasury. So it's a full agenda, and we're going to kick it off with Chris and Valerie. Take it away, you guys.
Thank you, Rich, and thank you, Johanna, for putting this together. The nice thing about these, as Rich mentioned, is that every week there's something new and something different. So we'll try not to focus on the past. We'll look a little bit ahead to the future. As Rich said, in the employment world, I think a week ago, the primary discussion was unemployment, the various options, shared work plans, permanent layoffs, temporary layoffs, partial unemployment, all that good stuff. So I'm going to assume that today that most of you, if you're in the sort of the layoff mode, that you've made those moves and you're now starting to think a little bit how to pull out of it, both from the perspective of whether you're a PPP loan recipient or otherwise. A couple of just sort of top issues in the unemployment world that we're seeing with our clients. One of the big issues is now we're ready to return our employees back to work. And what happens if an employee refuses to return to work? Whether that's, it could be for a variety of reasons. Could be simply because he or she has gotten used to receiving some pretty substantial unemployment benefits and would prefer to stay at home and receive benefits and not work. Or they could be legitimately, a COVID survivor. They could be someone who has to take care of a COVID survivor. So there could be a whole host of reasons why. But what the Department of Labor is indicating for employers, if you're in a situation where you're returning your employees back to work and an employee refuses to return, it's your responsibility, it's the employer's obligation to notify the Department of Labor that you've actually made a bona fide offer to return to work and an employee has refused. And what you're supposed to do is contact the DOL, the Connecticut DOL, at dol.meritrating@ct.gov. And you're supposed to send them a notice that you've provided a definite return to work date, that the employee has refused. If you have a reason why they're refusing, you should indicate that. But you give their name, their social security number, the return to work date, and the reason, if known, for their refusal to return to work. and the Department of Labor will schedule a hearing, and absent, you know, some compelling reason, like, you know, that might qualify them for some emergency paid sick leave or some extended FMLA, the Department of Labor will make a decision as to whether they're eligible to remain on unemployment. So that's, I know with some of you, as with PPP loans, you're concerned about, you know, the forgiveness period, and what if I can't get back to my FTE equivalents during that 8-week period. My suggestion would be to, if you know that that's coming down the pike, to start communicating to your furloughed employees now about a return to work date. You don't have to give it to them definite at the start, but start sort of, you know, communicating with them, if you're not already, that, you know, we're going to be returning our workforce, and give them an estimated date so that they can start making plans to return to work. But the main point is just that the obligation is on the employer to do that. The other sort of news on the unemployment front, obviously, is some of your employees may this week have received their first $600 check under the federal unemployment assistance program. Those are actually, I've heard, are going out this week. Typically what's happening is they're receiving that first $600 check, and then in the first installment, and then followed by usually a lump sum sort of retroactive payment back to the you know, their first entitlement for unemployment. So those, you know, for your employees that are struggling, there is some good news on the way, and some relief on the way if it hasn't already arrived in their bank accounts. That they do not have to apply separately for the PUA, the PUA assistance. That should come automatically. So hopefully they'll be seeing that check in their bank accounts this week, or certainly next week. With respect to the other unemployment, the federal unemployment, the FPU, FPUC, that's the one where the federal government is offering extended benefits for individuals who weren't otherwise qualified for state unemployment. We're told that there should be some guidance out this week, probably April 30th, about how that program's going to work, how to apply for it. And that's for individuals that either were not eligible for unemployment, have expired or exhausted their unemployment, or they might be an independent contractor who wouldn't have been eligible for unemployment in the first place. So in the world of unemployment, things are moving along. The claims are being processed a lot faster. If you're a shared work participant, you know, a couple weeks ago, I would have told you that if you file for a shared work application, it's going to take about 30 days to hear back from the Department of Labor. They're now saying that they've got that timeline down to about 2 weeks. If you have questions, like I said at the outset, I figured I wouldn't cover those alternatives today, but certainly happy to have a conversation offline if you have questions about partial unemployment, shared work, temporary versus permanent, you know, all that good stuff. So that being said, the good news is, in addition to that, is that we are now starting to talk about returning to work. When that takes place is anybody's guess, but, you know, weeks ago, Valerie and I were counseling clients on the first families first, on the emergency paid sick leave, on the extended family medical leave, then unemployment, and now we're starting to get a lot of questions about, you know, what the workplace is going to look like when we actually return our employees to work. So we're starting to now provide some guidance and some help with you know, what we would call a return to work plan that employers can use to sort of phase their employees back into the workplace. Obviously, there's a ton of guidance out there. You can look at the White House Opening America Again. There's some good guidance there where the federal government has, you know, given some guidance on a phased-in approach to returning your employees to work. The executive orders coming out of the state government are very helpful. Valerie's going to talk about one of those in particular. And as Rich mentioned at the outset, we have a number of alerts and some guidance on our website at uks.com. But the what we're talking to clients about a lot is returning to work and how to do that. Are you going to return to work sort of as a phased in approach with different return dates for different employees, staggering work schedules? But most of the work is centering around a really good and thorough review of your existing policies and procedures. And you're going to be adding to those policy and procedures. If you're going to do, for instance, a health screening, or if you're going to take temperatures of your employees, each morning before they come into work, it's best to have a policy in place because consistency with these policies is critically important. What we want to avoid is obviously any kind of discriminatory impact of how we conduct these types of tests. But under the relaxed EEOC standards, employers are now going to be able to do those things that they might not have been able to do in the past, like take temperatures and do health screenings. Those would all have been considered medical exams and prohibited by the ADA, but the EEOC has come out with some new guidance, loosening those restrictions and allowing you to do those types of tests to make sure that you're returning your employees safely to the workplace. So we're seeing policies on the health screening, on the COVID testing, on the provision of PPE, sanitation measures in the workplace with respect to face masks and disinfectants, and then obviously social distancing in the workplace. I have a 25-year-old daughter who's upstairs now from New York for 6 weeks, and she works for a company in New York that basically does all office furniture and outfitting. And weeks ago, before this, the whole idea was to expand the workplace, open creative workspaces. Now she says all they're doing is reordering, the dividing walls and the cubicles and creating, going back to what they were trying to move away from, several weeks ago. So we're sort of back to where we started in terms of some of the office space. But you're going to want to look at creating policies with regard to social distancing in the workplace and whatnot. But these reentry plans or these return to work plans, the important thing obviously is to avoid potential discrimination complaints. And so we need to make sure that the plans are consistent and that they're not directed at any particular protected status, but rather a general application to all employees. And that, the other thing that we're seeing a lot now of, and some employers are doing a better job than others, is just, constant communication with your employees, keeping them up to date, advising them of, what you're doing to create a safe workplace, providing them with appropriate resources from either CDC or OSHA to indicate, what you're doing to create a safe workplace. Some employers are establishing hotlines, for employees to call, or even putting up frequently asked questions on their websites for their employees that have, general questions that can be answered in a general way. And so I think that that's probably going to be the focus for us over the next few weeks, is working with our clients to help them reestablish their workforce if they've laid them off, bring them back safely, establish certain policies and procedures to help them bring the employees back in a safe environment, and also then counseling on what to do. We expect there's going to be some resistance to coming back to work by some employees, and then there's also going to be, some employees who legitimately can't come back to work due to either a disability or a serious health condition, and we're going to be back sort of in the realm of counseling about FMLA leave and the interaction between FMLA and paid sick leave or the emergency paid sick leave. But those will be sort of some of the trickier issues with respect to getting the workforce back. As I mentioned, Valerie was going to talk in particular about one of the executive orders that came out and the alert that we put together, which is available on our website. So Valerie, can I turn it over to you?
Sure. Thanks, Chris. As you're all aware, I'm sure, Governor Lamont entered Executive Order 7BB, which is the face mask order, which requires all citizens to wear a face covering or a mask in public whenever there's close contact is unavoidable. And he did say in the order that this extends to the workplace. He requested further specification from the Department of Economic and Community Development. And since then, the DECD has issued safe workplace rules for essential employers. So these rules are meant to help employers who are still operating right now as essential. But we think that they'll also be kind of a guidebook when businesses are allowed to open in the future. So it's important for both essential employers and non-essential employers to take these into account when they're either writing policies for now or policies for reopening. The most significant is the mask requirement. The DECD says that all employees are required to wear a mask while in the workplace, except while they're eating or drinking. But this does vary based on where employees are, if they're in a segregated space or a congregated space. The DECD says that once an employee is in a segregated space, such as a cubicle with walls or a private office, they can then remove their mask. But if they're going to travel in outside of their workstation, such as in a common area, a hallway or stairwell, then they should put the mask back on. The DECD says that in more congregated employment settings, such as manufacturing floors, warehouses, or like what Chris was saying, office space that's very open and there's people within 6 feet of each other, then employees should wear a mask while the entire time they're working, except of course when they're eating or drinking. Employers should issue masks to their employees. And if they're unable to provide them because of a shortage or of a supply chain difficulty, employers should be prepared to provide the materials that are necessary for employees to make their own or compensate employees reimburse them for the materials so that they can make one for themselves. So it kind of puts the onus on the employer to make sure all of the employees have the proper face mask or covering for their nose and mouth. These requirements don't apply to individuals who can't wear a mask due to medical reasons, and individuals don't have to provide any documentation for their medical conditions. So just so employers know that you shouldn't have to ask people if they aren't wearing one and they say it's for a medical condition, then you just kind of let it be. Aside from the mask requirement, there's two other categories of safety measures that the DECD wants employers to focus on. And that's controlling contact and eliminating transmission points. Of course, they want workplaces to continue social distancing, which we've been doing, and avoiding gatherings and meetings that are more than 10 people. And if there is an in-person meeting, everybody should be wearing masks. You should limit the amount of visitors that are on your premises, only those who are essential. Visitors, and you can also ask visitors whether they've had their current health conditions and recent travel history. DECD wants employers to have soap and water, hand sanitizer, or wipes available both to visitors and to employees at the exit and entrance points of their facilities. As Chris mentioned, workplaces with multiple shifts, the DECD wants employers to try to utilize nights and weekends as much as possible with shift workers, move maybe from one or two shifts to three shifts, keeping the same people on the same shifts each day so that employees are only coming into contact with the same people each day. So if there is a COVID-19 case, there's only a small amount of people who are possibly exposed. Of course, this is impossible in every work setting. A lot of employers operate without shifts, just a regular 9-to-5. So the DECD says, try to segment your workplace into different zones. Even if you don't do that now, try to implement and prohibit employees from moving away from the areas in which they need to work. And just try to create as much closed spaces as possible. For some of our bigger employers, if you have break rooms or cafeterias, the DECD says have employees start bringing their lunches rather than using a cafeteria. Eat at their workstation rather than in groups in a break room or in their cars. And again, providing soap and water in those areas, the coffee station is very important. With regard to eliminating transmission points, just some tips that the DECD has was installing no-touch disposal receptacles, providing disposable wipes in all the common areas like printers, scanners, things like that, and near doorknobs, keyboards, just anything that needs to be wiped down, just to make sure employees have the proper tools to do that. Prohibit employees from using other people's desks, offices, or work tools as much as possible. And if you really have to have workspaces that are shared, make sure to disinfect that equipment every day and before and after use daily. The EPA has a list of products that they recommend for disinfecting, and that's available on the EPA website. Encourage employees to clean their own personal workspaces at the beginning and end of each day. These were just some of the more important rules or basic ones to start you off, but there are additional rules online and specific rules for manufacturing employers as well as construction employers. So if you need any assistance in finding those or creating a policy, feel free to reach out to someone from our firm. And I think that covers my main points, and feel free to submit questions and we can deal with those after.
There we go. Sorry about that. It's trying to unmute me. Can you guys hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that. I was on mute. All right. Thanks, Chris. And thanks, Valerie. I know we have a couple of questions about employment issues related to your comments, but I think we're going to save those to the end. Don't mean to put everybody on hold, but we have a few other speakers to get through. We want to leave about 15 minutes at the end to discuss Q&A. So thank you for your questions. You can put them in the chat function and we'll make sure we get to them at the end. I wanted to speak briefly, and I know, like I said, we have two other speakers. I want to speak briefly about the PPP loan program itself. Companies are starting to get funded now. The amounts are hitting your accounts. And now that you've got those funds, you know, how do you use it? What are the eligible uses? What are some of the forgiveness terms? And I think Don will talk about the tax aspects of this, and Rick will talk about some of the fraud related aspects if you don't use it, or if you lied about using it, or how you're going to use it. So you really do have to follow the rules here, and you have to understand what the rules are. So let me just briefly run through what the CARES Act says about the use of the PPP loan proceeds. They can lawfully be used for a variety of purposes under normal SBA loans, including payroll, costs related to the continuation of group health benefits, rent payments, mortgage interest payments, utility payments, interest on other debt, and all of that's allowed and eligible under the PPP loan. The SBA came out with the interim rule related to this that really was the one that said 75% of the PPP loan needs to be used for payroll-related expenses. And that's really the idea here, is to get people back to work as quickly as possible, get the economy moving as quickly as possible again. And that, you know, if you use portions that are, you know, of the loan not for those the right purposes, it's going to have to be repaid and it won't be forgiven. So the 75% rule, the 75-25% rule really relates to those qualified payroll expenses. And that's defined as, you know, salary, obviously wages, commissions, any similar compensation up to $100,000. Over $100,000 is not eligible. And that's annualized over the course of the year. So, and that would also include things like cash tips or the equivalent of that, any vacation or family medical leave or sick leave that would be paid to the employees, any separation or dismissal pay, group health insurance benefits, retirement benefits, and any payroll taxes, state and local, not federal payroll taxes. So you put all those numbers together, and if it's 75%, you can, up to 75% of it is eligible for forgiveness if it's used for those purposes, and paid during the 8-week period from the time when you get the loan. So starting on the day that you get the loan, you have 8 weeks to disperse the funds in accordance with the rules. And again, 75% of it should be used for payroll. And if it is, it's eligible for forgiveness. Some of the questions that we're running into about that: are self-employed people eligible for that? If you're the owner of a company, maybe you haven't been on payroll and you haven't been considered an employee for payroll purposes, are you eligible to pay yourself from these funds? Short answer is yes. Treasury came out with guidance along with the SBA on April 6th that basically said that if you're an owner of the company and you work and you're actively involved in the company, you can be considered an employee for the purposes of using your own salary for meeting that 75%. In terms of some of the other things that are covered by the PPP loan, other eligible expenses on that 25% side would be things like mortgage interest. If you have mortgage payments on property that you're using for your business, the interest payments would be eligible for forgiveness. Again, not principal, but it's one of those qualified expenses. Rent payment as well. Those rent and mortgage payments need to be pursuant to loans or leases that were in place prior to February 15th of 2020. So if you have a new lease, you know, in the last month, that's not eligible. It has to be something that ongoing business concern and related to your business since before February 15th of 2020. There's no current guidance on past due rent or interest expenses. So if you're late on your rent, you know, there's no guidance on whether or not that's eligible, because the eligibility requirements are from the time that you got the loan for the next 8 weeks. We're still waiting on guidance on the SBA for things like rent payments that are late or past due. Deferred interest is another issue. If your bank has deferred interest on a loan and you haven't paid it, but now that you want to pay it because you got the PPP loan, there's a question as to whether or not that's actually an eligible expense. We're still waiting on guidance on that. I would think that that's okay, but again, we don't have clear guidance from the SBA on that yet, and we're still waiting to hear. If you're an existing SBA borrower and your interest was deferred originally back in March, and you now got a PPP loan, the PPP loan can be used to pay that interest. And then also the SBA is also paying 6 months worth of principal and interest on your existing SBA loan. And that starts as soon as you, it starts now actually, on existing SBA loans. And there's some interplay there between the SBA, existing SBA loans and the new PPP loan that you have to be aware of. And again, the SBA is still coming out with guidance on this on a daily basis. Some questions about utilities. Again, as long as your utilities were in place prior to February 15th, 2020, and they're ongoing, they're eligible to be paid with that other 25% of the PPP loan. Again, there's not clear guidance on if you're late on your utilities, whether or not you can go back and pay past due payments. And also, you know, what really, you know, electricity and gas and oil, that those are definitely utilities. Internet and phone are utilities, but there's not clear guidance on things that you might be subscribing to or using as a utility in your business. So point of sale systems, software and subscriptions, things like that. Again, not clear guidance on whether or not that constitutes a utility. And we're waiting on further guidance from the SBA on that. Those are some real, I'm trying to be cognizant of the time. Those are some just high level issues that we're dealing with from the PPP loan. And certainly as this evolves, we'll be providing, you know, more updates on our website. And if you have any questions, you can call one of us on the line here or our firms directly. I'm going to turn it over to Don Seifel now, who's on the phone, to talk about some state and tax aspects of all of this stuff. Don, you got it?
Okay. I am. Are you? Good afternoon, everybody. All right. So on the PPP loan, if you get loan forgiveness, one of the important aspects of that is that Section 1106 of the CARES Act says that it's not taxable income, so it's excludable from your taxable income for both federal and most states that track the federal reporting system. One question that remains uncertain is that 1106 of the CARES Act did not amend Section 108 of the Internal Revenue Code, which basically says if you get loan forgiveness, either in a bankruptcy or insolvency exception, you need to, under Section 1017 of the code, reduce your tax attributes, which are net operating loss carryovers or carrybacks, or your depreciable basis in assets. So we're still waiting from guidance on Treasury on whether that's going to be applicable or not. Again, we have plenty of time for you folks to file your 2020 federal corporate partnership and LLC returns. But that's a question that remains to be open. Usually, again, if you're getting a loan for giving the quid pro quos, you reduce your tax attributes. Whether that will be applicable or not, stay tuned. So we'll you know, wait and see. And again, remember, 75% of that loan has to be used for eligible payroll in that 8-week period. So if you're a restaurant that's not open, and you don't have any employees coming back or no customers, you're not going to be able to meet that criteria. So it's kind of like a Pyrrhic victory. You also have this situation if you're a restaurant and you're only 50% open. Some businesses, you know, don't have 75% of their overhead expenses attributable to payroll. So there's some, you know, practical guidelines and you know, hoops that you're going to have to jump through. And so it sounds great, but if you don't have employees to cover it, it's kind of moot, so you may not, you know, be able to get the benefit of that loan forgiveness. Switching gears to federal, state, and local issues, the U.S. Treasury announced rather broad, extensive filing and payment extensions. That's found in IRS Notice 2020-23, and it provides that all federal due date extensions that generally apply to taxpayers filing and making payment deadlines between April 1st and July 15th are extended to July 15th. That's individual income taxes, corporate, LLCs, partnerships, estate and gift taxes. And following suit, Governor Lamont promulgated Executive Order Number 7H, as in Harry, that says again, all Connecticut state income tax filings as well as income tax payments for 2019 are extended until July 15th, 2020. And those extensions also apply to estimated income tax payments for Q1 and Q2. And that's also the same rule for federal, too. So if you have corporate estimated income taxes, you don't have to make that payment until July 15th. Same thing with individual. Following the federal rule, Governor Lamont also and the DRS said that state and gift tax return filings and payment deadlines are also extended through July 15th, 2020. And again, guys, remember, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this. Connecticut is the only state in the union with a state gift tax requirement. So don't know if that's ever going to be different, but you know, if you have a CQ 709, you got further grace to file that until July 15th. The Department of Revenue Service has also extended automatic extension of sales and use tax and room occupancy tax payment relief for small businesses. And those are defined as small business taxpayers who had $150,000 or less in sales use or room cash occupancy during 2019, and that's the look back period. So monthly filings due March 31st and April 30th are extended to May 31st, and then quarterly filings due April 30th are extended through May 31st. Municipal real estate, motor vehicle, and personal property tax filing deadlines and payment deadlines have also been given relief under Governor Lamont's Executive Order 7S, as in Sam. And all municipalities must participate in one or both of these programs. So you got to look to each of your individual towns to see what they've adopted. They should be published on the town website, but again, this is town by town specific. The first is a deferral program. So for all filings and payments that are due before or between March 10th and July 1st, the municipalities must be giving you a 90-day extension on both filing and payment. The quid pro quo is that the taxpayer must attest that it has been significantly impacted economically by COVID-19 or is providing relief to those significantly affected. So that's signed under the penalties of perjury, so you may be audited, so you know, get your documentation in order. And again, I think throughout all of this, for the loan forgiveness, for eligibility, your documentation has to be pristine. So there won't be, I don't think, too much forgiveness for footballs here. The second program is a low interest rate. So if you defer your interest or your real estate, motor vehicle, or personal property tax payments, you're going to be charged 3%, which is much substantially lower than the old rate. Some of the CARES Act provisions applicable to corporate partnership and LLC employers. You have the option, if you don't get a PPP loan, to apply for an employer payroll tax deferral, and that's the employer share of FICA at 6.2%. That deferral period runs through December 31st, 2020. One half of the deferred 6.2% FICA has to be paid by December 31st, 2021, the remaining other half due December 31st, 2022. However, if you get a PPP loan, you're not eligible to take advantage of that employer payroll tax deferral. The next one is the employee retention credit, which will give the employer credit for qualified wages paid to employees during the period beginning March 13th, 2020 through December 31st, 2020. And that credit is equal to 50% of the qualified wages and is capped at $5,000 per employee. Again, you have to be able to attest that your operations have been affected by government orders due to COVID-19 or gross receipts for the quarter for the quarter in 2020 are less than 50% of the gross receipts for the same calendar quarter in 2019. Again, similar to the employer payroll tax deferral, if you get a PPP loan, you're not eligible to take that credit either. Then the Families First Response Act provided that employers can get a credit for employee retention, paid sick leave, and paid childcare leave credits, again, capped at $5,000. And unlike the PPP loan exclusion, you can, under the American Families First Act, get a credit for both the advanced credit program and the employee retention credit, but you can't double dip. You can't include the same wages. So you got to pick and choose what you want to do, but there's a little bit more flexibility under the Families First Act there. On the filing extensions and payment extensions, no separate extensions required. It's automatic. And likewise, no penalties or interest are accruing or incurred during that deferral period. So again, it's designed to enhance the employer's cash flow, and a lot of people are taking advantage of it. Secretary Munchen said that just the employer corporate payroll deferrals would be equal to $300 million for the first quarter. So that's a significant cash flow program. And that's about all I have for now. And again, we're available for questions later. So we're running out of time. Rick, I think you're up next.
I am. Thank you, Don. Good afternoon, everyone. I hope everyone's doing well, and thank you for joining us in this webinar. I'll be brief because I see that there are many questions in the chat room, probably mostly related to employment and other related issues. I wanted to just talk briefly about the False Claims Act and issues with regard to fraud that people should be concerned with and be mindful of. The best advice I can give is to be careful, to be diligent, and to be honest. The government has already come out and said that they will be looking very closely at these monies that have been issued, the trillions of dollars that have been provided in loans over the last several weeks and are still ongoing with people's applications with regard to the PPP and other programs. You've probably already seen that there are many high-profile companies, the Lakers, Harvard University, and others who applied for loan money and have already been, I'm not going to say compelled at this point, but have already given it back because they really didn't qualify and they weren't the companies that were supposed to be, for whom these programs were supposed to help. Everyone who applies for a PPP loan or other loan has to sign a certification, and that certification, you know, take it very seriously. There are very particular things within that certification that you are attesting to, and that you're going to, you know, the, in particular, the economic condition of your company, the economic uncertainty, the fact that you're unavailable to get money from other sources, the manner in which you intend to use that money, and things of that nature. The government is taking this very seriously, and I believe the Treasury Secretary has already come out in light of some of these high-profile public companies that have taken the money. The Treasury Secretary has already come out and said that all loans in excess of $2 million will be audited. It's only a matter of time once they get through the loans in excess of $2 million that they may then go and look at loans which were less than $2 million, which would be most likely the vast majority of loans which are for small businesses. So what you need to do is, number one, is to make sure that your certification was correct when you signed it, or if you're still applying for a loan. That's the most important thing. Number two is make sure that you use the money for the designated purposes which it's meant to be used for, and those are included in the certifications, and we've addressed those throughout the webinar here. And keep very, very good records. Money's fungible, so there's monies that you can use monies for that you would have on hand for one purpose, but it's really best to probably segregate these monies that you receive in loans and make sure that you use these monies only for the intended purposes. And you keep good records, be honest, and I think that many of you may expect, you can expect if you got a loan over a certain amount that you may very well be audited. And it's just, you have to be careful. The government takes this seriously. This is the most stimulus money that's ever been put out by the government. And there's already, I think, 8, congressional oversight committees. The CARES Act itself has appointed, several, inspectors to be auditing and to be looking at these loans. And the False Claims Act and fraud provisions also call for, not only civil penalties, which could be many times in excess of the amount of the loan, but also criminal penalties if they find that there was actual fraud committed in any regard. So that's really all I have. Happy to answer any questions about any of the particular, the particular fraud claims or provisions, but this is something that people have to be very cognizant of and be very careful with. So thank you.
There we go. Okay. Thanks, Rick. And thanks, Valerie, Chris, and Don as well. Let's go into the questions here. And I think we can kind of start at the top. From Teresa Cahill, question for you, Chris. What's the employer's obligation if you have to continue to pay an employee their full pay for working from home, and then when you reopen, they refuse to return to the office and want to continue to work from home? Hey, Joanna, can you unmute Chris, Valerie, and yep.
Thank you. I felt like restrained there for a second. Yeah, I tried to answer that in the chat, but absolutely, you know, the work from home policies during COVID are a temporary policy. Hopefully, your policy indicates that. If it doesn't, that's not fatal. The thing you want to look out for is just, you know, not, you want to be consistent and across the board. If we're returned to work and you want to end your work at home policy, you have every right to do that, and your employees have to come back to work unless, you know, there's a particular situation where it may be, you know, a reasonable accommodation for a disability, or you may decide to continue someone's, you know, remote working capacity for a short period of time due to the fact that, their own health condition that doesn't necessarily rise to a disability, or maybe they still have ongoing daycare that doesn't qualify for EFMLA. You can look at it at a case-by-case basis, but overall, you know, when this is over and you want to resume your work environment at the workplace, you have the right to do that. That being said, you know, I think a lot of employers are going to be reevaluating FaceTime in the office, and it may be that you'll create new remote work policies that allow some greater flexibility that sort of enhances productivity on behalf of some of your employees. But in general, there's no problem, you know, sort of rescinding that policy when this is over.
Great. Next question from Shufin Chocolates. What about ventilation changes, HVAC changes in the workplace? Any requirement to make those types of accommodations to return to work?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm the one to answer that, if I am, I would say that that's something that I haven't drilled down on in terms of OSHA requirements. I'd be happy to take a closer look at that. I don't know if anyone else has any specific answer to that, but that's one that I'd have to take a look at.
Well, DECD has just the more general requirement that employers try to increase ventilation rates and increase the percentage of outdoor air that comes in and circulates into their system wherever possible, but that doesn't really require them to do any HVAC changes. But I would just say that, you know, try to keep the windows open when it'll be nice out when we come back to work, hopefully. And but again, we can look at OSHA and see if there's anything further.
Okay. Thank you. From Derek Phelps, how does acceptance of a PPP loan complicate an employer's ability to lay off an employee for lack of need of work for one employee's services? Chris, you have?
Yeah, no, hi, Derek. If I understand the question, I think it's, you know, obviously the forgiveness period in terms of employees is, they're gonna be two factors that impact forgiveness. One is going to be that the payroll costs that are paid and incurred during that period, and then the other is the FTE equivalent count. So if you're going to lay someone off during that time period, even if it's unrelated to COVID, if it's just, you know, you're reducing the workforce, or that person, you know, is not performing satisfactorily, that could impact your FTE count, which could then impact your forgiveness. And it could impact your gross payroll as well. I can see Derek's.
You're trying to ask a question, Derek?
Yeah, I can't hear him though.
We can't hear you, Derek. Why don't you type it in? we'll move on a little bit here, just to keep it rolling.
Derek, we'll come back to you.
Thanks. Does the PPP loan include 1099 workers and consultants? I believe it does, and they're part of your overall payroll for your employment. So if you regularly employ a 1099 worker or a consultant, I do believe that's included in those types of costs that are eligible to go within that 75% payroll cost. Another one from Teresa. Can you add employees? How about temporary help in terms of rehiring and under the PPP loan? I believe you can. Mm-hmm. You know, the eligibility was based on how many employees you had at the time And, you know, at the time of the application, going forward, it's counting full-time employee equivalents. And I don't know, Chris, can you talk a little bit about what a full-time employee equivalent is and whether or not part-time employees are calculated in that?
Well, you're going to take two part-times, you know, and add them together to make a full-time. I think it's based on a 40-hour sort of work threshold. But the question about, it's an interesting question because I've had the question several times now that if we bring back our workforce, you know, in order to maximize forgiveness, and this goes on, you know, for a longer period of time into the summer, what happens if we go through a second round of furloughs? And there's nothing right now in the guidance that says, you know, after the 8-week period, you're restricted in terms of reducing your workforce again.
Yep, that's right. Kind of moving on, this is from Carrie Smith. Is the amount eligible for forgiveness payroll expenses and paid to employees during the 8-week period, or for payments made for work performed during the 8-week period? For example, I paid employees 2 days after I received the loan and work performed in the day period ending 4 days before I received the loan. I think what you're saying is it's a good question. The PPP says that the forgiveness is for payroll and expenses incurred and paid during the 8-week period. So that's tough for employees because typically you incur their payment, you know, for a period of time before you actually pay them. So what you're paying them this week was for services they provided last week, and they're going to come to the end of this 8-week period. And they're going to work for the last of the 8-week period, and you're going to pay them the following week outside that window. There's not any guidance on that yet. We're anticipating some because every employer in the world has had that question to the SBA, and we're waiting on some guidance on that. Hopefully, in the next 8 weeks, we get some clarity. But that's a really good question. That's the same question a lot of people are having.
Yeah, so, and Rich, just if I could add to that, because the question also comes up a lot about accelerating payroll, and that seems more acceptable, that as long as it's paid and incurred during the 8-week period, if someone's performed the work during the 8-week period, but the payroll is outside of the 8-week period, can you accelerate that payroll to pay it during the 8-week period? And that does seem possible.
Thank you, Chris. Is there guidance on what retirement costs are eligible? This is from Andy Bardino. No, as of yet, there's not. It's stated in there that can be included as one of the eligible payroll costs, but there's no guidance on that. It just says retirement costs. So I don't know if that's an employer match, right? It probably relates to an employer match or employer contribution to a 401k or something similar to that, but no specific guidance as of yet. Another one from Andy. What if only 70% went towards payroll? Would there be a prorated amount of the loan that would be forgiven? I think our understanding of that is yes, it's some sort of prorated forgiveness. I haven't seen an exact SBA guidance on that yet, but I do believe, I'm just reading from some of my notes here, that it is prorated based on the amount.
Rick, correct. It's prorated. And that applies to both FTE equivalents and your actual payroll in that 8-week period.
Thank you, Don. Kind of scrolling down from Katie. Can you review deferring payment of payroll and property taxes quickly once more? Probably not in the time allotted. happy to talk to you offline, Katie, and you know, give us a call. It's actually pretty complex, so we'll get through it though. And happy to, you know, connect through Johanna or to me directly. Can we include part-time employees in the PPP loan? Yes. How that's calculated in terms of the forgiveness. You're asking about what's forgivable. Short answer is yes. I think we're still waiting on some guidance as to how that's going to be calculated. Seasonal employees is another entire issue, and it's going to start coming up for those that are in, you know, the wedding service business or agriculture. or, you know, outdoor recreation, camps, things like that. We're getting a lot of questions about seasonal employees and if they don't fit within this 8-week period from, you know, essentially now for the next 8 weeks. And so again, still waiting on guidance on that, and hopefully we'll get some answers. So from Derek, so it's important to just keep an eye on the bottom line of how many full-time employee equivalents the employer has. Meaning if you have to happen to lay off one employee during the 8-week life of the PPP, but also take on a new employee during the same time, you come out okay. I think essentially that's right, Derek. Yeah. Yep. I think that, is there any more out there? Johanna, you're muted, Johanna.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have one over here. And reminder for those of you who are on the phone, if you want to get your questions in, send it to info@Middlesex Chamber. My question is, can the PPP be used as incentive, i.e. can you pay some employees more because they are working during this time, or just provide a bonus?
Who's that?
Yeah, I'll let Don weigh in on this, yeah. But we've been talking through that issue quite a bit this week, and from what I understand, that bonus, you've got to be very careful about trying to add in bonus payments that weren't otherwise, you know, part of the payroll. I don't know, Don, if you have any further thoughts on that, but there's been a bunch of alerts out there on that, you know, raising a caution flag about paying bonuses during the 8-week period.
Right. I mean, if you have a salary over $100,000, that's going to be excluded in any event. And you got basic principles of anti-discrimination. And I think going to Rick's issue, you got fraud that you have to be careful of. And again, you have to attest that these are your normal payroll costs. So I would be very wary of bonuses. But if you need to increase an hourly person's pay because they're a first-line responder or other essential person, I think that's allowed. And I think that will be, that's more acceptable in my mind, given what the parameters we've been seeing. So
yeah, that would be more in line with like hazard pay, which I think is understandable.
Right. So I think, you know, be careful out there. I'd be very wary of bonuses during that 8-week period.
Here's a specific question that just popped in actually to that. This person says they always bonus their employees at the start of June, since that is the culmination of their main season. So if I can show history of this bonus, would it be okay?
Yeah, I think that's fine, because that's the standard policy that you had for a long-standing period, and the employee has that expectation of receiving that. For instance, commissioned salespeople, you know, get bonuses or quarterly or monthly true-ups. I think that's, you know, fine, as long as you have a well-established programming system in place. Be prepared to defend it. And if your PPP loan is over $2 million, you're going to have somebody from the SBA knocking on your door. So have your documentation in place.
And Rich, if I could just jump in here for a second, I forgot to mention that if you look at the SBA guidance that was issued on April 24th, it does have a provision in there under question number 31 that if someone feels that they certified or requested a loan and their circumstances weren't, you know, that the information was not correct or that they didn't really qualify for the loan, they have until May 7th to pay the loan in full. And then the SBA will consider the certification to have been made in good faith. Not a very large window to make those determinations. But if you look to that SBA guidance, it is in there.
Okay, just another quick question. Does the amounts have to actually be paid or can it be accrued, i.e. retirement pay?
In terms of the PPP?
I believe so, yes.
I believe it has to be paid. I don't think you can accrue it. It has to be paid.
Right.
And not too many people fund their current non-elective contributions on a current basis. It's always accrued. Again, barring anything else from the SBA or Treasury, unless you pay it over to the 401k plan or profit sharing plan for that particular pay period, in that 8-week period, I don't think it's eligible.
Great.
I agree.
Thank you. All right, that's all the questions I have. Nothing's come into info app. So does anyone want to say anything in closing?
No, I just want to thank everybody. Thank Chris and Valerie and Rick and Don on the line. Appreciate all your time today. Everyone on the call is free to reach out to us or to Johanna to connect with us if you have any specific questions.
Can I say something, Rich?
Sure, Chris.
I think Irene should win the prize for best backdrop. I've been looking at that palm tree for the last
hour. Very relaxing. Very relaxing. I did send Katie a private message with your contact info, Rich, just so you know.
Okay.
Guys, thanks so much for all you've done. Truly appreciate it. There's a ton of great feedback here saying very good feedback. Thank you so much. So we appreciate you taking time as usual. Just to let everybody else know, tomorrow we do have another session. This is our town hall meeting with Matt Pugliese and Jim Jackson from the Connecticut Small Business Development Center. They will be discussing PPP and the EIDL. So if you want to join us, it's at 1 o'clock. You can check out our website. But beyond that, thanks again, the UKS team. Appreciate it. Everyone, I hope you have an awesome day and keep smiling. I love to see faces with smiles. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Rich.
Bye, Joanna.